The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this show are available for free. Your support makes a difference. If you would like to support this show, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Okay? Okay. Okay.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jesus, dude, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it was like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
All right, okay. Hey, everybody. Hello, how's it going? This is the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I am reporting to you from Los Angeles, and I'm very happy to have my good friend Adam Greenfield on the program today to celebrate the publication of his debut novel, Circa. It's available now from Pelicanesis Press. I think that's how you pronounce it. Is it Pelicanesis or Pelicanesis? I just texted Adam to ask him to verify. He didn't get back to me. I'm going to go with Pelicanesis because I went online and I Googled, like, how do you pronounce telekinesis? And this is what I heard. Let's see.
Telekinesis.
Yeah.
Telekinesis.
So I'm going to go with Pelicanesis. And that's the name of the press. The book is called Circa. Adam Greenfield, he and I coming up in just a second. I actually have to finish this monologue relatively quickly because I got to go down and see Adam do his reading, his book launch. So just thrilled for him. He's one of the most readerly people I know. He's constantly reading. He seems to have read everything. He's been working on this book for a long time, and now it's in print. It is also the official August pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is my online culture magazine and literary community. It has its own monthly book club. If you're interested in that, just go to TheNervousBreakdown.com. Otherwise, I'm trying to think of what... trying to think of what to tell you. What's been going on in my life? I've been up since 2 a.m. I woke up. I had to interview somebody today for the show. I'm not going to say who. I'm going to keep you in suspense. But sometimes I get nervous before an interview because I'll be thinking about it too much or I'll be worried about how it's going to go. So my eyes opened at 2 a.m. and I couldn't go back to sleep. And it wasn't just the podcast. Some of it's just that I can't sleep, you know, once I wake up. And then my stomach sort of achy. I think maybe because I drank too much coffee. I'm unclear. I didn't have a good night of sleep is what I'm saying. So I feel a little bit out of it. I feel a little bit woozy. I'm woozy. Gonna go to my friend Adam Greenfield's reading. His new book is called Circa. It's a novel. It's available from Pelicanesis Press. Right? Okay. So here we are. This is me and Adam. You want to hear me and Adam talk? This is me and Adam Greenfield.
I mean, I think I have realistic expectations.
Healthy.
Yeah.
You're not like secretly thinking like this could be it.
No way.
No way.
No way.
It's your first book.
It's the first book. It's not that kind of thing. It's not like a thriller. There's no crazy M. Night Shyamalan ending to it, you know.
Right.
It's
And you dedicated this to David, who's on every page?
Yeah.
Who is that?
David was one of my best friends growing up, and he died in March of 2015. Suicide.
Oh, he was a suicide.
Suicide. And he just kind of a big influence in my life. And
how long did you know him?
Since seventh grade.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why did he kill himself? Do you know?
He was always going to kill himself. He told me in ninth grade that he was going to kill himself. And he's had a lot of depression, a lot of like maybe bipolar disorder. You know, he was never sure. He was in and out of therapy his whole life. And
did he get medicated?
He got medicated. He got off medication. He drank too much for a time. He always had a plan. That was his thing. He always talked about having a plan to kill himself. And when he was feeling really good, I remember asking him one time how he was doing. And he's like, I don't have a plan for the first time in my life. But
it came
he
back.
Did. It came back.
God, how did he kill himself?
This is so morbid, but there's a thing you can buy online called a suicide bag.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
You know about that?
You told me about this, but that's like where you put it over your head.
Yeah, and it comes with a tank of, I think it's helium, and you cinch it around the neck. This is so morbid. You cinch it around the neck, excuse me, and then you you do the tank and you fall asleep, and it's like supposedly an incredibly painless way to die. But there's somebody who actually sells them, and I think it was a woman, an older woman, who did it, who put it together for her husband who was terminally ill, and she kind of invented this thing.
By the way, this is how we're starting our conversation.
Great.
right out of the gates.
Yeah, welcome everyone.
Well, that's awful, man. I lost a buddy to, you know that I lost a buddy to suicide. And
yeah.
Here's what I think about suicide. I've been working on this book, and I do write a little bit about my buddy in it. I think I will. And I've also lost a friend to opiate overdose, which I feel like is a kind of self-destruction.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite as intentional, but still like feels like a self-destruction, you know, when somebody loses their life to substance abuse. And what I think about in terms of my own experience of life, if I'm thinking back, is that I never experienced any kind of suicidal ideation of my own until my buddy killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it became like a real thing. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, you can, people do this.
Yeah.
And I was 19 or 20 years old. And after that, it's not that I'm suicidal, but it became like this, I don't know, it just became realer. And it became part of my imagination.
Yeah.
In a way that it wasn't previously. And I sort of hate that. It's like kind of like a curse in a way or something. I feel like I want to get it out, but
no, it stays with you. And then you want to, in my case, I wanted to know about that moment. Like I was so fixated on
me too.
That moment. Like what was he thinking? And I'm really of the, so I've had four friends kill themselves. I've had dealt with four suicides and,
oh my God.
Yeah. David was my closest friend, but there's been others. And I really think that people might be prone to it, but I think the actual act of killing yourself is very situational. I think like a lot of times, like when Dave died, they got his phone and like there was a shopping list on his phone of things he was going to get from the market the next day. So I think like if he had just gotten through that night,
right,
he probably would have been okay.
He
might have killed himself at some point, but I think, you know, it was like a conflagration of causes or like things that were going on. And
well, I called my buddy the night that he killed himself and I didn't get him. I left a voicemail. And I always think about that. Like, what if he had answered?
Yeah.
Like, what if we had had a chance to talk?
Yeah.
And so it plays head games with you because there's so much mystery around that moment. But to add to what you just said, I completely agree about the situationality, if that's a word, of suicide. I know that people have, neurochemical predispositions and difficulties, and it's to greater and lesser extents. You know, some people really have a darkness in them or a difficult situation medically, but you know, I feel like feelings, like emotions, are all temporary.
Mm-hmm.
You think about any emotion you've ever felt in your life. You know, however happy or sad or angry, none of them have ever remained.
Right.
There's nothing static about it.
Yeah.
And so I always just want to grab my friend and say, look, it's temporary. Don't kill yourself because of one feeling.
Right.
It's like you get stuck there.
But that's, you can't talk anyone out of that situation because it's like it's the most magnetic situation of all time. You know, when you're in that moment and you're at the bottom of despair and you can't see any way out, you cannot talk anyone out of that. You know, it's like trying to convince someone, you know, you're not high or you're not, you can't do it.
I feel like, you know, there's a part of me that wants to believe that I could, but I get it. People get stuck. Like I think about Bourdain.
Yeah.
And Kate Spade and Bourdain happened within the same few days. And I talked about it a little bit, I think, on the show at some point. But it stays with me. And I have like an essay that I want to write. I don't know. I find myself ruminating about Bourdain in particular just because I was a real fan of his show and his work. And just kind of liked him, you know. Like I think a lot of people, he's just a good guy. And I like to rib him a little bit about his hardcoreness.
Yeah.
Like his show, he's like constantly trying to be like manly with the tattoos.
Well, he's really cynical and everything sucks.
Everything sucks. And I like punk rock and I like to do jujitsu and you know what I'm saying?
Used to shoot heroin.
Uh-huh. But I guess like the essay that I want to write, which I don't know if I'll get around to, which I might just instead talk myself through here, is, or it has to do with this sort of the celebration of consumption that was sort of at the heart of his show, like just kind of like wonton consumption, not wonton soup, but, like,
right, no, yes.
But just like, I'll eat anything.
Yeah.
And I remember there was this quote that I was reading in the aftermath of his suicide where it was like, he was talking about how, like, you know, the body is a, or life is a carnival, take the ride, your body, you know, I forget what it is, but it was basically trying to say like, look, eat everything, fuck it, you know, enjoy your body, just put whatever into it. And
yeah,
I kind of feel like, no, that's part of the problem. Like, I don't know, I'm going to say this badly, but I actually disagree. I don't think you should just shovel anything into your mouth and call it like a celebration of different cultures. Like, we got to think things through. And I feel like there is a history of substance abuse in Bourdain's life that was sort of tied to that attitude. And it was never fully resolved, because like, he was a guy who like had struggles with heroin, but then could kind of drink. And I don't know, I don't want to judge, but I feel like I keep thinking about that. And I feel like, you know, then Jonathan Gold died, and it was sort of the same thing. It's like, there's like this celebration. Am I saying this so poorly? I like, there's a celebration of like, eat whatever the fuck you want, don't consider the consequences.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I mean, you're talking about gluttony, right?
Gluttony and consumption, but not just food consumption, consumption writ large. It seemed to be emblematic of a larger problem in our culture, especially in American culture, where we don't consider the consequences of what we consume, whether it's food, whether it's, you know, drink, whether it's culture, like a cult, like media, social media. Like, I think we actually do need to pause and consider the consequences more. We need to have a higher level of consciousness. And, you know, yeah, well, what about how this food got to my plate? What about the animals that suffered? What about the ecological consequences? Like, I'm not a lame, namby-pamby spoil sport because I want to think about these things, am I?
No. No, I mean, I think Bourdain was trying to, like, you know, use food as a way to, like, sneak some kind of cultural education to people who might not otherwise ever know, like, what Indonesia is, or that, like, a place like Laos exists.
Right.
You know, it was like he snuck in some history about these countries and the cultures and the people, and he did it under the guise of like a food show. And it was probably a good way to do it, you know?
Yeah.
As good a way as any. I mean, the problem with all those things, and like the problem with like Vice also, for example, like that takes these like cultural snapshots, that really oversimplifies situations, I think, a little too much, you know? You don't get a lot of context. But people seem to love these kinds of shows where like a Hunter S. Thompson kind of roguish, you know, fucked up journalist goes into a place and like mixes it up with the locals. And
Hunter Thompson's sort of a similar case where,
yeah. Well, he was like the progenitor.
I mean, yeah, like where like consumption, like celebrating consumption without any real
ramifications,
consideration of ramifications or consequences, not only to his own health, but to the health of everybody around him.
Yeah.
Like there's a destructiveness to it.
But that builds up the persona. Like, that's why he's such a rebel, right?
I think because we need to move away from that, though. Yeah. I feel like we shouldn't be celebrating.
There's a place for it. But, I mean, if we all live like that, yeah, then we'd be fucked if we were like a society of Hunter S. Thompsons.
Like, I think as a character, like the Raoul Duke character, especially like in Fear and Loathing, and also, you know, but both the Fear and Loathing books, like the election book and then Las Vegas, like, that's fantastic. Like, I completely celebrate it as a fiction.
Yeah.
But I think in real life, especially, like, after the age of 45, you just see, like, the, you know, you dig deep into the biographies. It was, you know, it was not pretty.
No.
And it was hard on people who were around him, you know, his family and stuff, so.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't want to sit here up on my high horse and judge. I just think it's worthy of consideration. And what I find, as I was like reading through all the media in the aftermath of Bourdain's death, just as like one example, is that I wasn't hearing anybody say that. I wasn't hearing anybody say, well, wait, like what? I don't know. I don't want to. I think in the broadest sense, he was a really positive force and a very gifted guy, you know, a writer, media personality, entertainer, whatever you want to call him. But I just think that,
it was entertainment, but that show, I mean, I kind of stopped watching it years ago because I felt it to be a little repetitive after a while. But what was I going to say? You know, it was entertainment. I don't know. I didn't really think about it, I guess.
I feel like it reinforces some message that,
well, like the ugly American.
No. I think he actually, like, in terms of his engagement with other cultures, it's the opposite of the ugly American. He's very respectful. That's what people loved him around the world, because he actually met them on their own terms. And that's where Bourdain is so great.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But I just think it reinforces some attitude that's very American about, like, eat it all, you know, like have everything and fuck the consequences and life's a party. And it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, like, I look at climate change as an example. I'm like, that's sort of why the fucking earth is melting.
Yeah.
But
some people, you're never going to convince them to care about politics. I mean, even though, like, you know, I'm not saying climate change is politics, because it should supersede politics or be above it. But some people just don't give a shit. I just read the biography of Lou Reed, and the biographer was writing, like, he didn't really care. He didn't care about politics one way or the other, you know, and like, especially in today's day and age, to think that you don't have an opinion about what's going on seems kind of incredible or hard to believe. But I think there are people who are either they're self-obsessed, or they just, I don't know, they're not built that way. They're not wired that way, but they're, you know, and it's not even like that they're in it for themselves. I think they do have an agenda that's beyond self-serving. It's just like they want to live a certain way. They want to consume. They want to make art, and, you know. I think it's called being up your own ass a little.
Well,
bit.
I think it's, yeah, I think there's also an emotional component, especially, I mean, if we're talking about food, but also if we're talking about media, anything people consume on a regular basis, I think, you know, it can be used as a way to numb oneself, you know, to get away from feelings and to get away from the whatever's going on internally. You know, you turn on the TV, you open your phone, you go to the pantry or the refrigerator. I mean, right? These are the ways in which we sort of numb ourselves against,
yeah,
our, you know, the pain of being human.
Yeah.
But I think that the truth is that if we want to actually, in a significant and lasting way, mitigate against the pain of being human, we have to do the opposite of numbing ourselves. We have to lean into it, to go into our suffering and, like, actually engage with it and look at it and investigate it, and then take care of ourselves in a way that makes some sense. Otherwise, all you're going to be doing is temporarily numbing yourself. And by doing that repeatedly, you actually wind up self-harming. That's what I think.
I mean, I think I always kind of bristle at, you know, people who suffer from, like, severe depression. If you don't have that in your life, you know, and I've had some of that in my life, people who don't have it and they see you from the outside, they're, you know, it's constantly, well, just snap out of it.
Yeah, like, go exercise.
Yeah, like, like, eat more fucking ancient grains. You'll be fine. It's not like that. You cannot talk your way out of it. You can't eat your way out of it.
Right.
You know, there's that gulf of, it's just a big misunderstanding. It's just, I don't know. I mean, you know, my friend David.
It can't be treated. I mean, there is such a thing as mental health care.
There is, of course.
Sometimes you need meds.
Doesn't help everyone, though. I mean,
you think there's some people who are beyond help?
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing that anyone can do. They're wiring. They're on a dark path.
Yeah, because I think it's so situational. I think at some point, even if they're, like, maintaining and they're 90%, they're okay. If, you know, during one of those downturns and, you know, they have a suicide bag in the closet, or, you know, they have a bottle of sleeping pills, it's going to be hard to stop them.
Right. Well, don't have a fucking suicide bag in the closet.
Well, yeah. That's going back to, like, I always have a plan, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's, it's really tough. And I think that, you know, the other thing that I think about suicide and suicidal ideation is that there's a lot of shame around it. And I think that more people, then the statistics would bear, a significantly higher number of people struggle with depression and, you know, have suicidal ideation as part of their psychology than would ever admit it. It's not something people are, like, racing to raise their hand and admit to.
Right.
But I think it's actually, I think there's different degrees of it. I think there are people like your friend David who is, like, he seriously had a plan. And then there are people like me who it's more of a philosophical thing. Like, wow, you can take your own life.
Yeah.
Like, under what circumstances would you do that? And, like, I'm not somebody who, I don't think I would do that.
Yeah.
Unless, like, you know, nukes were on their way.
I don't either. I mean, I've never been that, I've never been in those depths, or I've never been in that state of mind, you know? I mean, I've been down, I've been depressed, but like,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, there's a far cry between that and like, you know, having the barrel of the gun against your temple, you know?
I think I'm just too conscious of...
I feel too guilty.
Well, yeah, right. I'm too conscious of how much people are relying on me. Like my kids.
They're not.
They'd actually just get out of the way, old man. But I feel like having been on the receiving end of losing somebody to suicide and knowing how that feels, like to do that to somebody else is not something that computes with me. And then also just being like, and I think that this, and this is going to sound real, I'm going to get eye rolls for saying this, but doing meditation has really opened my eyes to like the temporary nature of feelings. Like, I don't trust my feelings, and that's a good thing. Like, I watch them come and go. I see the insanity of my mind every morning and evening, and you just watch that. I watch it come and go, and you start to learn, like, oh, so this is just what the mind does, and oh, this is just what the feelings do. Like, it's like storm clouds, you know? They blow through, and I feel like I'm solid enough in my understanding that, like, the storm doesn't stay.
Yeah.
And it's part of being human to a degree to have storms blow through.
It is. Again, I think it's like... you can't know what that person's going through in that moment, you know?
Right,
it's
right.
Just, and the whole thing, like, I mean, I'm sure people will hate me for saying this, but I don't really think it's a selfish act. I don't think people are thinking about other people when they're in the depths of, you know, that much depression or
but
that
isn't,
much
isn't
sadness.
Isn't that the definition of selfish, to not be thinking about anybody else, or is it different?
Well, yeah, it is. But I think, like, being depressed and, you know, being neurotic, I think a lot of that is, I mean, it's... not self-conscious narcissism, but it is. I mean, it's like, you know, you're obsessed with yourself. You're obsessed with your feelings. You're thinking about stuff all the time. You're thinking about how things affect you. I think you get caught up in yourself, you know? Like, so I think, yeah, to a degree, suicide is a narcissistic act. But I don't think it's like something that someone's doing to somebody else.
Right. And it's also like, you know, we talk about the word selfish. Like, it's like, it's not like, oh, you know, there's a plate full of cookies and I want them all.
Right. I want those, like, suicide cookies.
Yeah, I want those suicide cookies. It's not like that. I think what you're speaking to is more like a feeling of overwhelm.
Mm-hmm.
I think when people get lost in themselves to that degree, like there's neurochemical stuff happening or emotional stuff happening, and it's a state of overwhelm, and you just don't see beyond that. And it's not like some conscious, like, I want it all for me.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah, yeah.
It's, there's, I don't know. It just doesn't feel quite like the traditional understanding of selfishness. And I think that, you know, there's illness involved. And I think that, you know, feelings of despair and isolation and, desperation are common to us all. Like, even if we're not people who are at risk, I think we all, as human beings, like as human animals, in some corner of ourselves can relate and can understand. And it's just difficult when somebody follows through.
Yeah.
You know, I feel, we all feel it. It's a weird kind of grief, and it's a weird way to lose somebody, and it has a weird effect on the collective consciousness. Well, even if it's news of like a celebrity, you know?
It's really hard to understand it. I think that that's the thing that makes it so devastating, is like, you want to know, again, you want to know what that person was thinking. You want to know what that person was feeling. You almost want to like be in that place at that time.
Right.
I remember,
like, there's a morbidity, like, you really, cause I'm the same way. Like, wow, my buddy hanged himself. And I'm like, so he went into the closet and he cinched up this belt, and it's just like, what the fuck?
It's so intense. Yeah. I mean, that is a really fucking violent way to kill yourself. And then, like, what are you doing to the people who have to find you? You know,
right.
Can you imagine like somebody walking in, like a loved one or something? I mean, like sleeping pills, at least you're sleeping and, you know, it's kind of a little bit more less, it's less violent, but like hanging yourself or shooting yourself. I mean, that's almost like a fuck you to people.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, that's the thing too, is that there's a lot of anger.
Hope he left that hotel maid a nice tip.
Who, Bourdain? But it was Eric Rappaport, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who, by the way, is like his, like...
his best friend, right?
His best friend, but also like the dude who's like Buddhist and...
Right.
I feel like the fact that Bourdain killed himself there, knowing that Rappaport would probably find him, I think he probably considered that. Maybe. I think about that relationship.
And I feel so bad for Eric. Like, that's got to suck.
Yeah.
I mean, what a horrible thing to have to discover. So anyway, it's dark. I'm sorry about your buddy. It's nice. I mean, how nice of you to have like written a book as a kind of tribute to him.
Yeah. I mean, he died in the middle of me writing it. So, he kind of factored into a lot of it, even, you know, obviously before he died. And so it kind of altered everything. And then actually, not to really bum everyone out, but
let's bring this down another notch if we could.
My father also passed away in the middle of me writing this, and he was another big
not a suicide. Yeah,
he was another big kind of character in the story. And so like he died and then David died, and it was just like
this. How did your dad die?
He had cancer.
Okay.
Multiple myeloma.
Oh, right.
And he, so you know, like, so at a certain point, I was like, this book is killing people.
Yeah, right.
Like, I'm like, that's its own book. I can write you in here and you die.
Oh, my God. So, I mean, we're buddies. And so I know, like, the broad outlines of your childhood. But you grew up, I don't know a lot of the details.
Yeah.
So, like, let's get into it. You grew up in Los Angeles. You're a lifer.
Yeah, I'm a lifer. I grew up in the Pacific Palisades.
Nice neighborhood.
Like out by the beach.
It's out by the beach. So for people who don't have context in Los Angeles, like the Palisades are sort of like above Santa Monica.
Yeah, between Santa Monica and Malibu, or Santa Monica and Topanga, yeah, Malibu.
But like up on a bluff, basically above the ocean.
Part of it's up on a bluff. And then, you know, if you drive Sunset to the beach, where Sunset ends, it kind of ends in the Palisades, but you go through... Sunset ends at the beach. You have to go through the Palisades to get there. So, you know, there's flats, there's stuff in canyons. I lived up in a part of the Palisades called the Highlands, which was like this development from the early 70s, very like tract home kind of development.
Like E.T. shit?
Yeah, a little bit like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And like celebrities around? Like, like when you were a kid, is it like celebrities in your classes and stuff?
Not my class.
Or celebrity spawn?
Yeah, there were celebrity neighbors. My next door neighbor was Wink Martindale.
No. what was it?
Newlywed Game?
No, it was a game show. Joker's Wild?
No, it was a weird one. No, it was one of those couple dating games.
Fuck, I'm going to look it up.
All right, look it up.
Because I remember, the game show host name, Wink Martindale.
But
Tic-tac-toe?
Is that what it was?
Well, that's what it says on Wikipedia. Hang on. He had a multivaried career.
He was a renaissance man.
Tic-tac-toe, High Rollers, Debt, Gambit, disc jockey, radio personality, game show host, television producer.
Yeah.
So he was your next door neighbor. Did you like know Wink?
No, he moved out when I was pretty young. I mean, we, you know, saw him a bit. But yeah, I mean, Chevy Chase lived in the neighborhood. Ted Knight lived in the neighborhood.
Did you see Chevy around?
Yeah. All the time.
I've heard he's a dick.
That's what I hear. I mean, I didn't know him at all.
Okay.
But
I saw him hiking once, which was really weird and out of context.
Up at Runyon?
Yeah. I was like, what the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah.
I didn't say anything, but...
I was just watching Fletch again the other night. It's such a funny movie.
I know. That's the thing that troubles me about Chevy is that, like, I love Fletch, Spies Like Us.
Yeah.
Right?
And Caddyshack.
Caddyshack. So, like, he was, like, a hero of mine as a kid, but then... There's this oral history of Saturday Night Live that I read years ago.
Yeah.
You know those big, like, huge behemoth oral histories?
I know which one you're talking about.
Everybody hated him.
Yeah.
He's like a spectacular dick to like the cast members.
Well, he was only on for a season, right? And he was like kind of a breakout star, and he got.
And then he was like, "I'm going to go out and be a movie star."
Yeah. And he did.
But then like he would come back to do like the guest hosting thing, and he would like walk into 30 Rock or whatever and just like shit on everybody.
Yeah. Sounds good.
It's a good life.
Sounds great. I aspire to that.
Maybe I'm overstating it. But anyhow, so Chevy Chase was in the neighborhood.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Dom DeLuise.
I share a birthday with Dom DeLuise.
Do you?
Yeah.
His son was at school with me. He was a couple years older than
me.
What
was his name?
David.
Oh, okay.
David DeLuise. Yeah.
All right. So, but it was a different LA back then.
It was. I mean, I tell people I'm from the Pacific Palisades and they, you know, they're like, they think I'm a spoiled rich kid or something. And it really wasn't like that back then. My parents, when they were trying to buy a house, they were either going to move to the Valley or to the Palisades, and houses were the same amount of money in both those places.
My friend who grew up out in the Valley, And so for people listening, you know, the Hollywood Hills, like on one side is the LA basin, on the other side is the San Fernando Valley. Mm-hmm. So LA proper is in the basin, and then the valley is the valley. It's hotter out there, but it's sort of like back in the day in the '70s, it was like suburban.
Yeah.
If you wanted to raise your family, get a more affordable house, have maybe a little bit more space, you know, that was where you went. And I have a friend who was raised in, God, I'm going to forget the name. It begins with a T. Not Topanga.
Tarzana.
And her parents, at the time that they were looking for a house, were looking at Tarzana and Malibu. And they bought in Tarzana. But you could have gotten a house in Malibu back in the day, like close to the beach.
For the same amount of money.
And that same house, all these years later, would be worth exponentially more.
Right, of course.
So, I mean, to have bought property in Malibu back in like the 60s and 70s, you would have made out like a bandit.
Yeah. I mean, if you bought anywhere in LA, you would have made out like a bandit in the long run. You know, I remember my dad always, oh, property can't go up anymore. There's no way it could get more expensive than this.
Yeah.
You know? But he was a lawyer and he had a law firm in the Pacific, in the Palisades. So that's why.
What kind of law?
He did like civil litigation. He was in court a lot. Like he did a lot of divorce law towards the end.
Never run out of business. And
he was so miserable. He hated it so much.
Did he?
Yeah. It really made him nuts. He was like, they're the most, I remember him like coming home from work and just, you know, people going through divorce. He's like, they're the most miserable people in the world.
It's hard.
It's the worst. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, not to keep bringing this down, but it's like divorce.
No, let's do it.
It's like a death. I feel like there's a similarity between the grief one experiences at the loss of a loved one and the grief one experiences at the loss of a love. Like when you think you're going to be with somebody forever, you make these vows and then things go sideways. A person betrays you, lets you down. It's a toxic relationship. You're fighting. And finally, it just like reaches a boiling point and breaks. I feel like people who are going through that, I don't know. Am I making sense? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't gone through it, but I would hate it. I would go to almost, I mean, as you know, I'm married. Like I would go to almost any lengths not to get divorced.
I feel similarly. And I feel like I'm not I always say this. I'm not like a traditionalist as a person. I don't care about holidays. I'm not sentimental about almost anything. But I am unusually affected by news of divorce. Really bothers me when I don't like to hear about people's marriages breaking
even
up.
Even people you don't know, like celebrities.
I'm just like, I'm just like, oh, like fuck. I was feeling, you know, I wanted them to make it.
You're such a romantic.
Well, but I also, because I'm not like a religious person. Like I don't respond, you know, to religious dogma. But I do hold sacred in my life my wedding vows. Like I made a vow. And I'm going to stick to it. Like, I believe in being a person of your word, you know? And I know sometimes things go sideways and a relationship becomes untenable. I'm a realist. You know, I know that not every marriage can make it and not every marriage should make it. But, like, I'm not somebody who takes that lightly. And I think, like, I don't know, I've said this before to people and they're like, whoa, like, relax, man. But I'm like, no, but isn't that what it's all about? You actually like push all the religious context aside. Like you're looking at somebody saying like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're going to give it your best shot. You know, I think that's what you're saying.
But that means like in sickness and in health, like well, things aren't good. Things are not going to go well. That's the whole, like I knew that from the beginning.
But things, like you said, things go sideways. I have friends who are going through divorces now, you know, it's kind of like that first tier of it. And they certainly never planned on it. And if you saw them a couple of years ago, you never would have guessed it. And then you try to figure it out, and then you inevitably take one side or the other. And then you got to sit back and say, you don't know what was going on in that marriage. You don't know what the other person who seems so innocent was doing or not doing or not saying. And it's such a personal thing. I don't know. You can never know what's really going on.
What I always say whenever I'm offering unsolicited advice to friends who are about to get married or solicited advice, not that I do this that often, but I give this advice to myself, even though I don't always follow it, is that in a relationship, if you want it to last, speaking or acting from anger is the last thing you should do. Or like that's something you should work strenuously to avoid. And it's really hard because you get annoyed, you know, like it could be the littlest thing.
Yeah.
But if you feel that, like take a breath, take a walk, don't act on it, don't speak from it. That will go a long way. Because I think what fells a lot of relationships is the accumulation of unmindful speech. You say things that are hurtful. It's like death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
It's rarely like some huge blow up. It's like this build.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think my wife and I, we always talk about this. Like, I hate fighting. I hate confrontation.
Right.
And she feels like it's good for us. Like you're saying, she's like, it's better that we get it out, you know, here and there, rather than let it all build up and then have like one colossal fight. But I don't like it. It's like almost like that ritualistic, like jihad, you know, like to fight for, you know, the fight for fight's sake. But
there has to be a dialogue, and that, like, I think conflict is inevitable. Like, you're going to have some conflict and dialogue, but it's the way in which it's context. It's like how you discuss it, where you discuss it, what your tone is.
We fight frequently about not fighting enough. Like, that's a recurring thing to us. Yeah, we talked about it last night.
I'm like, I'm a really verbal person who, like, I'm happy to discuss anything. Carrie is more like the Minnesota Scandinavian. Like, I'm the Sicilian, she's the Minnesota Scandinavian, repressed. Like, not going to talk, you know? So I think that's, like, the balance.
Sounds like a sitcom.
It kind of is.
Yeah.
She's like a Bergman movie, and I'm like, I don't know. This is getting precious, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I feel like it hopefully evens itself out, because maybe, like, I want to discuss things too much, and her, like, reticence, I can kind of bring her out, and she can sort of, like, tamp me down a little
bit. Yeah. Ellen and I are the same, I think. I think it's good to have some differences, you know, like to balance each other out. But when you're both kind of like, she likes the idea of us fighting more, but she's also not very confrontational. So, like, we both stew on it in different ways. But
these are relationships. Like, I don't think you can be in relation to another person intimately, whether it's a friendship or a spouse or a significant other of any kind, for any extended period of time and not have this be a component. It's just a normal part of being human, but it's just how you navigate it. And I think ultimately, if both parties are operating in good faith and from the position of wanting to maintain and stay connected and in love or whatever it is, you have a pretty decent shot of weathering whatever storms come along. And I think that, you know, like, I'm the great beneficiary of my wife's patience. She's like a really patient person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, her dad, like, couldn't even physically yell. He's literally one of those people. He could not yell. Couldn't. Like, if he wanted to, he couldn't. He just had this quiet voice, and he's infinitely patient kind of guy, you know, but, you know, and she sort of got that. So I'm sort of like crossing my fingers, like, maybe my kids will get the can't yell thing. Like, that seems kind of like
But you don't want to you don't want to not have any voice. I have two kids, and one is very, like, apologetic and a little subservient, and the other one is, like, you know, hell-bent for leather all the time. And, like, I kind of wish each one had a little bit of the other, uh-huh. You know, instead of being so extreme.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I don't think you can get two. You'd rarely get two who are the same.
Yeah.
I can't quite tell yet what my, like, I, you know, Evan's pretty much like Carrie, but maybe she's got a little bit of me. I feel like daughters are often like their fathers and sons are often like their mothers.
Yeah.
That's a generalization.
Yeah. I don't know. I got two daughters.
So, okay. So, raised in the Palisades, different time in LA.
Different time.
Dad was a lawyer. Mom was
Travel agent.
Travel agent.
Still is.
Happy, but like happy childhood? Do you have a sibling? You have siblings?
Well, I have a sister.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I have a sister I grew up with.
Right.
But I have this crazy fertility story.
Okay. I want to get to that.
All right.
That's because I feel like this is like, first of all, this, I feel like, has a story you need to tell somehow.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre, you know, so wild.
Yeah. Although I'm finding out it's not that uncommon. Like,
no.
The more people I talk to.
It's not something that's, like, unprecedented.
Right.
But it is unique.
It's unique.
So you grow up relatively happy kid?
Yeah. I was happy once I found, like, a group of good friends. Then, you know, we were very close and did stuff together and, you know, we're really, like, a family. My dad and I didn't get along very well.
Why not?
We're just very different people. Like, he was kind of a jock and a frat boy and, you know, very rah-rah. And he was very, like, self-centered kind of person. And I don't know. He wasn't, like, really that interested in me. I had to, like, kind of meet him where he was a lot more than he met me where I was. So
I worry that I'm sort of like that.
With your kids?
Well, just because I don't like to play like dolls and shit.
I know, but there's a difference between that and like, I mean, my dad was like obsessed with baseball cards. That was his like huge hobby. He had a huge baseball card collection. And if I wanted to spend any time with him, I had to go to these baseball card conventions with him. And I had like almost no interest in it. But like I had to learn like a ton about baseball and all this shit. And, you know, it was like trying to sleep with a girl and you're like, oh no, I'm totally into ice skating. But,
right.
You know, you have to fucking do it.
You do what you want. Yeah, you do what you have to do. But, so you and your sister.
Yep.
You had good friends. You're a social person.
Yeah.
You're not somebody who's, I mean, for a writer, you're not like some cloistered. You like, you get out, you have a lot of friends. You still have a lot of these friendships to this day.
Yeah.
People you grew up with.
Yeah.
And then adolescence, were you a popular kid in high school?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Nerdy. Were you like a target of ridicule?
No. I was just kind of like anonymous, I think, a little bit. I had, this really good group of friends. There were probably six or eight of us, and we liked punk rock, and we played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, and we hung out together every minute we could. And
drugs? Alcohol? Like, do you have like any kind of like Brettys to Nellis-y part?
No, not like that at all. I mean, yeah, I experimented with drugs, but it wasn't like, you know, we were doing coke off each other's Porsches or anything like that. It was like,
I'm sorry, that didn't happen. Sorry that didn't happen for you.
You and me both, buddy. Yeah, I mean, a little bit, and it was, you know, I was interested in it.
Yeah. And then you go to Michigan for college.
I went to UC Santa Barbara for the first 2 years.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And then what happened?
I never really wanted to go there in the first place, but my father didn't want to pay for me to do my general eds out of state because he was pretty cheap. So
right.
He's like, do your first 2 years in state and then you can transfer to where you want to go. And UCSB was fine in the long run.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful, but I mean, I grew up at the beach. I had no affinity for the beach. I fucking hate the beach, to be honest with you.
I don't love the beach either.
I hate beach culture.
Yeah.
I was totally like traumatized by it, to be honest with you.
I like to swim in the ocean. I will say that. Like, I like to get in the water, but like, I don't like to sit on the beach.
I hate it. I sand everywhere and fucking
it's dirty.
Surfers. And I'm sick of all of it.
I'm too pale too.
You're really pale.
I can't do the sun.
No.
Like, I'm not somebody who can just be out in the sun all day. So when I think about like vacationing or going to like, you know, I don't want to do it. I just have to sit in the shade all the time.
No, I'd rather do like a city and do some museums and walk around.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not a beach person at all.
But I do like to swim in the ocean.
All right.
Like I like that.
We'll go sometime.
But I feel like it's filthy.
It's dirty.
So why would we go there? I don't want to go there.
Maybe we'll go to a different ocean.
Yeah.
Not this ocean.
So, okay. So you go to UCSB.
2 years.
And like you didn't like, you built up, I'm sure, some friendships there.
Yeah.
And then you were like, fuck it, I'm out of here. I'm going to Michigan.
I'm going somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And why Michigan?
I was interested in political science and they had a really good political science department.
Well, that's a very pragmatic decision.
Yeah. I mean, I applied to a few places.
And why political science?
I've always been interested in politics and, you know, wanted to study it. I knew I wanted to like major in that and, you know, learn what I could. And
does that factor in?
No.
To your book?
No, not at all.
So it's not a political book?
No, not at all.
Do you think you would ever write a political book?
No. I'm kind of done with politics. I mean, I'm kind of done being interested in politics, I think.
But I feel like politics is hard to write about in a way that's not dissimilar to like spiritual concerns being hard to write about. Like, because both have something to do with dogma.
And I don't think I have anything new to say about politics.
That,
you know,
too.
Like, I think everything's been said. I think everyone's incredibly activated right now on one side or the other. And everyone's got opinions. Everyone's an expert on everything. It's just, there's no fucking room for anybody. Nobody needs my voice added to that, you know? I mean, I have opinions, but I kind of keep them to myself. And all my friends kind of feel the same way I do about everything. So what's the point, you know? We're just reinforcing each other's anger.
I agree to a degree. But I do think there's something to information warfare. I think that it sounds kind of extreme, but I think that's kind of the situation we find ourselves in. And I do think that we need to try to amplify facts and stories that need to cut through. And if we don't, then there are going to be bots and nefarious actors who amplify disinformation and counter messages. Like, I think like individual citizens have a responsibility to engage, even if it just means sharing stories and you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like nobody's listening to anybody, so you might as well not even try. I mean, honestly. I mean, if we know something is fact and the other side says it's not fact, that it's a lie, what are you ever going to do to prove it? Even if you showed them proof, even if you play people tapes of what they said or what they heard or something that definitively happened, they can still choose not to believe it anymore. Yeah, so what's the point?
Fake news.
Yeah, fake news.
Did you have any inkling, like when you studied political science, like were you reading about fascist dictatorships and how, do you know what I'm saying? Did you have any inkling of the festering disease in our body politic? Did you have a sense of it creeping?
No, not at all. I mean, I think like, you know, you're aware that politics was kind of fucked up and that the system was broken, but it always felt like it couldn't get any worse than it is already. And then every cycle, it seems to get like a little bit worse. So now I'm just kind of open to whatever kind of free fall, you know, might be in store for
like,
us.
Yeah, like where's bottom?
There is no bottom.
You don't think there is?
No. I think like at this point, the government and the presidency in particular are irredeemable. It'll never be the same. It'll never be what it was. You know what trips me out though? I think about this a lot. The same way that we hate Trump, the same way that, you know, we can't find a thing to agree with him on, we can't find a single point of empathy for any of his positions or feelings. That's the way people felt about Obama, you know, and like to try to put yourself in their shoes, you can't do it.
But those people are insane.
But that's the thing. And they're saying the exact same thing about you.
But like the thing about it is that like, they're like, I'm saying it on the merits. Like there's a difference. It's a false equivalence. That drives me crazy. Like Obama was not perfect. No president is. There's plenty of legitimate reasons to criticize him. And I'm open to that. I'm open to having like a debate, operating from a mutual set of facts. But where I'm not open is where people start to debate using their own realities. Like we have to have some foundation.
That's the thing. Objectivity is gone.
Ugh, well, we need to get it back.
How?
I don't know. Let's figure it out.
All right.
So you're studying political science. You're at Michigan. How was going from being like an LA kid your whole life, Palisades, Santa Barbara, and then suddenly being in Ann Arbor?
I loved it.
You loved it.
I really did. Yeah. I mean, I'd seen snow once before in my entire life. So like, you know, like living through a winter and the beautiful snow everywhere. And it was a dream.
There's
know?
Something sort of Midwestern about you. I feel like you in a way that many native Los Angelinos or Californians don't tend to present themselves. You seem somebody who would like fit well in the Midwest.
I like the Midwest a
That's
lot.
A compliment, by
yeah,
the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, I do. I like it. I went to grad school in Chicago. I really like Chicago. My wife's from Minnesota, like yours. Like, we've talked about moving there. I'm actually much more for it than she is. I would go in a heartbeat.
Into Minneapolis?
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the winter might bum me out. I'd have to see how I could do.
Yeah. But then, like, you have something to look forward to when the winter ends, you know? Like, here or, like, you have nothing. It's just the same, like, hot day over and over and over.
It's too fucking hot in the summer.
It's awful.
I don't like the summer.
Something. I say this every year, but something feels really broken now with the weather or the climate or something. Like even the air just looks like yellow. It just looks like everything's about to burst into flames at all times.
Fuck. I know.
We're gonna have to start dealing with like spontaneous human combustion. Like that's gonna be like the big political platform.
Just human bodies just bursting into flames.
Like fake news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so then you go to University of Chicago and get your master's degree?
Yeah.
In
Middle Eastern studies.
Oh, right. Okay. And then you go to, did you go travel abroad and study or did you?
Yeah, I was in the Middle East for a while and then.
Where in the Middle East?
I was in Jerusalem. I was in Israel. I was in the West Bank. Traveled to Egypt. I was in Cairo for a little bit.
With the idea of doing what? Of learning?
I was going to get my PhD in Middle Eastern history.
Why that? I mean, you're Jewish.
Jewish.
So did that have that? Was that an influence, like wanting to understand?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was part of it. I mean, the big influence, honestly, was seeing Lawrence of Arabia when I was a kid and just like being in love with that era of history and wanting to learn all about it. And then that kind of took me away into it. But yeah, and I was really into it. I was going to, again, get my doctorate. And
why didn't you?
Because it was like almost time to start thinking of what I would want to write a dissertation on, and I had no idea.
Yeah.
And the thought of like putting 4 years into something that I wasn't even half-assed about. I wasn't even half-assed because I didn't even know what it was.
What did you learn on the ground in the Middle East? Like, you go there fresh out of, or you're a grad student, young, probably more idealistic than you are now.
I mean, you know, you see the conditions people are living in, and you see the effects of colonialism and imperialism, and it makes you develop a real empathy for people, and, you know, gives you a real sense of what things. I mean, I have a really specific opinion about things in the Middle East.
Which is what?
Well, I'm not a big Israel supporter, you know?
Which is like, this is the thing. There are Jews. I think people who are not Jewish often assume that all Jews are like
Zionists.
Yeah. And that's not the case.
No.
But yet there is like a strong cultural identity. What I would say as a non-Jew is that I totally get the idea of post-World War II Jews wanting to establish their own place and way to defend themselves. But there's like a really blatant irony in the fact that like after being excommunicated and executed and like all the horrors that happened to Jewish people in World War II, they then went to Israel and pushed people out of their homes.
Yeah.
Took their, you know what I'm saying? So yeah. It's like, why can't there be some acknowledgement of that? There's got to be. And like the thing is that like now that it's this far down the pike, like what? Like the Jews aren't all going to pack up and leave Israel.
No.
But there has to be some acknowledgement of wrongdoing and like a two-state solution. That's what's got to happen?
Yeah. I mean, in my opinion, like what has to happen, like what the bones of a peace deal are pretty clear. I think everyone really knows what those are, you know, like two-state solution. You have to let the Palestinians have a capital in East Jerusalem, which is East Jerusalem's de facto a Palestinian city anyway.
But they're living sort of they're kind of barricaded in, right?
Well, now I haven't been there in so long, but there's a wall now up between the West Bank and Israel. So, but I mean, Jerusalem is, you know, it's one city, but like Jews, back when I was there anyway, Jews really didn't go into East Jerusalem very much, you know?
Yeah. I was there in 2012. I went to Jerusalem.
Oh, that's right. I remember you were doing some research, right? About organ donation.
Yeah. But I loved it. I thought it was beautiful. I mean, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. I mean, I was there for a short time, but I enjoyed my time there, and I didn't get into like the, you know, I was pretty traditional tourist route.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to see.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's an amazing place.
But I just feel like Netanyahu's, he seems like a dark force to me.
Yeah.
He seems like Dick Cheney. That's how I equate him in my mind. He feels like the Jewish dick. He's just like a hardliner.
Did you say he's the Jewish dick?
Dick. I just don't think he's helping. That's what bothers me about him. I feel like he's actively harming the chance for peace.
Yeah.
And he seems like, he seems very eager to drop bombs on Iran, on Iran, and it's like, tamp it down, dude. Let's not be so militaristic. Like, let's try to broker a solution that's going to lead to peaceful coexistence.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that, you know, in a way, I mean, these are apples and oranges, but I think that maybe there's some similarity. Like, I think about racial injustice in the United States and the persisting tensions and injustices that we keep seeing over and over again. And then I think about the issue of reparations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think when there has been systemic injustice perpetrated over, you know, centuries or decades, and it's that big and that long lasting, if there is any chance of genuine healing to happen, there has to be some sort of reparation made. Some sort of, even if it, like, there's got to be a real gesture made. And I think that in addition to having a two-state solution, there would have to be some acknowledgement of like, you know what, we fucked up. We pushed you out of your homes. Like, we're sorry. We're sorry. And like, not only are we sorry, but we're going to like try to make good on it and be in the form of like financial reparations or some concession of, or like, concession of land.
No, I mean, I mean, that's part of this. I mean, that's part of what has to happen. They'll never give the land back, but they should give them something, you know, having to live in refugee camps since 1948.
Right. And it's like, let's narrow this down like microcosmically. Like, if you're in a relationship with another human being and you fuck up really badly or do something really awful to somebody, you're not going to repair that relationship unless you first acknowledge that you did something wrong and you say you're sorry and you try to make it better. Why can't we do this as nation states?
You know? I feel like this is like the preschool edition of Other People. Like, can we just get along?
Hey, but listen, sometimes I feel like our leadership, our political leadership, would do well to go like visit a fucking kindergarten class and watch how the kids are taught to get along.
Yeah.
Because some of those lessons carry over.
Fake news.
God, I can get soapboxy, but I'm very frustrated as somebody who engages with political news way too much. I find myself feeling maddened, you know, by it, like by the insanity of it, like the persistent insanity of it.
Yeah. I mean, I want to do something. I feel like, I mean, you remember when you were a kid and you would read about, you'd read some chapter, terrible chapter in history about slavery or about the Holocaust or what have you. And you were like, if I was alive during that time, I would have done something, or I would have really, you know, made a difference, or I wouldn't have stood for it. And right. Now here we are in one of those times. And I don't know what to do. I don't know.
I go out to marches. I'm donating. I'm fucking tweeting like a crazy person, which is not nothing. I will defend that.
I'm not criticizing your tweeting.
I know, but I'm just saying that, like, the only reason I'm preemptively defending it is that it does feel like a trifle. It's like, how hard is it to retweet something? But, like, I'm increasingly, especially as we approach the midterms, of the belief that in volume, in mass volume, American citizens of conscience and hopefully some of discriminating minds who are able to parse the news, because that's part of the problem is media literacy. I feel like people who don't have a sense of the terrain don't know who to ingest. You know what I'm saying? Like, who do you read? What do you watch?
Yeah.
Like, I think some people just get on a certain track and like can sort of become hypnotized.
Yeah.
You know, you're listening to right-wing radio or you're watching Fox. Like,
well, everyone thinks they have the great news outlet, you know, like that's like,
I get that, but like I'm watching MSNBC sometimes. I'm also watching CBS and I'm watching ABC and I'm reading David Frum and I'm reading George Will and I'm reading Wall Street Journal articles and I'm reading New York Times and Washington Post articles. And I feel like the Washington Post has done a more exemplary job in this era than any major newspaper. And like, I feel like I can parse it, and I'm not trying to like pat myself on the back too much, but like, I think there are people who, like, if you spend enough time digging into this stuff, you do start to develop a sense of where the good shit is and how to like process and how to be skeptical.
Yeah.
You know, of your own biases and, you know, of what you're taking in. And like, you have to have a quick willingness, and this has happened to me more than once in this era, you have to be quick to recognize when you've fucked it up.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes I can get caught in a shitty article. Like, I'll retweet it and then like, whoa, I just learned that it was actually bullshit, or, you know, disinformation, or like improperly sourced. And, you know, I don't know.
There's someone out there who hates everything, you know, like there's a group out there who hates the New York Times, that they gave too much attention to Trump when he was running. And they're the reason that Trump got elected president. Or
I think there's something fishy going on in pockets of the New York Times.
I think
history will bear that out. I think there's something funny with money. And I think that some of these journalists, like some of these access journalists who have been on the Trump beat, have been either like irresponsible or idiotic or both. But I think I smell something weird there. And I'm basing that on like a kind of a broad.
I mean, they've had a pretty like, they've been beating the drum against Trump, like, you know, pretty steadily since he got elected.
Except when they published that story that the, you know, there was no evidence or connection at all of, you know, a Russian investigation. Remember, well, that
part of this is like their react. News sources are reacting so quickly to everything instead of letting kind of things play out a little bit. So they're publishing things as soon as they happen.
That was a big fucking error.
Because there's competition. Yeah, I know.
That was a big like right before the election.
But also, like, who's reading the New York Times? It's only Democrats. So it doesn't really. They're
no,
just speaking.
No, because here's what I would say: people in the media, in the mainstream press, and in local newspapers across the country, it's still the gray lady. Like, it's a source, and it when they make a claim or they publish a story, it reverberates. So you have anchormen and anchorwomen and pundits and local reporters, you know, there's a ripple effect. And so there is real consequence. I don't necessarily think it carries the same weight it did in like mid 20th century, but it matters. It still matters. And
I get everything from InfoWars.
Breitbart.
Yeah.
So anyhow, you are one of the most voracious readers. Oh, you know what we didn't get to? I want to get to that before we get to reading and writing, is the story of your...
Oh, my parentage?
Yeah, because this is unique and I think is increasing like a big part of who you are. I mean, it's had, obviously has had a big effect over the last few years.
Yeah. Do you want me to just tell the story?
Sure, yeah. Let people know what it is.
All right, so I'm 45 now. When I was just after my 40th birthday, I took that 23andMe test.
Yeah.
Just on a whim. Total, you know, a friend of mine told me about it. I thought it sounded interesting. There's always been so much kind of ambiguity about my family's background. Took the test, spit in the thing, waited 6 weeks, got the results back. And the results were a little weird right away because I always thought I was 100% Jewish. And it was like, you're 70% Jewish and you're 30% like European, non-Jewish. And I was like, oh, that's strange. I wonder what that's about. And then I go into the database section where, you know, you link up with people that you're related to. And I had all these distant cousins, but I had one really close relative that I shared 25% of DNA with. And it was like, this person's your grandson. I was like, what the fuck? And we...
Is your grandson? Is,
so it runs this algorithm. And
wait,
so,
do you have a grandchild?
No.
Oh. Okay.
No, it saw the algorithm. It saw the thing. It said, oh, you share 25% of your DNA with this person. That's how much a grandchild and a grandparent shares. It's also the same amount of DNA that half siblings share.
Right.
So it turned out to be a half sibling. I get in touch with this guy. He's 11 years younger than me. He found out that his parents used a sperm donor from the sperm clinic at UCLA, fertility clinic at UCLA. My dad went to UCLA, so we thought immediately that my dad must have donated sperm when he was a college student. Absolutely does not sound like my dad. He was not like a real giver, even.
I gave so much sperm in college. It was crazy.
Did you really?
No, I'm just kidding.
A lot of listies out
just,
there.
Yeah, I just wanted to know.
God, there's so many podcasts in the Boulder area. We don't know why.
Hundreds of thousands of podcasts spawn out there roaming the earth.
Just with sure microphones everywhere. So we thought, anyway, we thought this guy was my dad's kid. Turns out, and then kind of going around and around on it. And then finally my mom calls me one night and she's like, I have something to tell you. Dad's not your dad. Like, dad's not your biological father. We used a sperm donor because we couldn't get pregnant. So,
how did you receive that news? Like, in the moment?
I knew she was about to say something crazy. So, I put the phone on speaker and I held it up so Ellen could hear also. And Ellen was just like wide eyed. And my mom's prone to exaggeration. So, I was like, is she full of shit? Like, what is she talking about? But, you know, yeah, I was just shocked, you know, and she got really defensive. She's like, are you mad at me? Are you mad? I'm like, I'm not mad at you. I'm just trying to fucking process this, you know?
Right, right.
And I asked her, I go, when were you going to tell me? And she goes, on my deathbed.
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah, thanks, Mom.
What would you have preferred from the start knowing? Do you have a sense of like when you would?
No, I think I found out at the right time, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Because my father had passed away. I didn't have to have an awkward conversation with him about it. You know, I had a family, I have a career. I'm not like desperately in search of an identity. I think some of my half siblings who I've discovered since then are really like hell bent on finding out everything they can about this.
How many half siblings have you found so far?
24.
And so like, yeah, it's just so crazy. You meet and you're connecting with these people. You've had like dinner with them and stuff.
Seven of us got together for dinner in December. Yeah. It was fun.
And you meet like a half sister or a half brother with whom you share what, a quarter of your genetics?
Yeah. I'm still the oldest, by the way.
You
of
are?
All 24. Yeah.
Okay. And do you feel a connection? Or is it like, you know what I'm saying? Like when you meet these people, is there some like real like animal recognition or like where you really have like an immediate rapport? Or do you feel like maybe that's just like a psychological trick because you know you're related?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, in a few of them, there's definitely been things like the first guy I met, we met for coffee down here on Larchmont and we were walking and, you know, I was trying to break the ice. So like, as a joke, I look over at him and I go, so how's that depression and OCD been treating you these last 30 years? You know? And he like looked at me really wide eyed and I'm like, and you know, he was going through it the same as me. And then
yeah,
we were interviewed for this documentary about donor conceived children and the interviewer had us and she turned the camera off and she goes, you guys should look at yourselves right now. And we looked down and we were like both sitting the exact same way with our legs crossed the exact same way and our kind of posture the same. So I think, you know, there's something about, there's yeah. something biological there. And one of the half brothers is a writer and, you know, he's, but there, and there's definitely like been this depression neuroses thing that everyone seems to kind of been suffering through and from, all the siblings. But unfortunately, I don't feel really a lot of connection with them. And I've been kind of pulling away lately, actually, because first it was really interesting and exciting, but it just got to be too much.
24.
It's too much.
How many do you think there might be?
I mean, there could be 100. I don't know.
Damn.
Yeah. This guy was like cocked and loaded. We know who it is, by the way.
And you know, yeah. you know who the dad is.
Yeah.
Have you met him?
No, he's not interested. And I'm not interested, to be honest with you. I don't care. We got a hold of one of his sons, like his, you know, real sons.
Yeah.
And he's like, just wanted you to let you know, my dad's fine. There's no like family illnesses. There's no disease. That's all I needed to know. Like I definitely was not looking for another father. But some of my half siblings are like, I'm going to drive up there to Washington and I'm just going to knock on his door. Be like, what? And do what?
Can you imagine donating sperm when you're like in college and then like 30 years later, like 50 people come back being like, Dad.
What a nightmare.
Yeah. I don't want to know. Just don't, you know, if you're going to do that, like, I think there's something benevolent about being a sperm donor
yeah.
because look, your parents wanted to have a child, couldn't conceive. He gave them the opportunity to have a child. That's
yeah.
it's not nothing.
No, it's not nothing. And you know, he made a few bucks and whatever he was paying for his books or his beer money or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a buddy who's
we all ejaculate for different reasons.
I have a buddy who's a gay guy and donated sperm years ago. And then, like, I want to say it was twins. They came knocking. And they have, like, a relationship now.
Were they over 18?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
But they came back and they were like, you're my dad, and or, you know, you're my biological dad.
Well, they're moving towards, I mean, there's this whole donor-conceived community that I kind of started to dip my toe in and then just pulled way back from. But, I mean, there's people who are really, like, wrecked by this, by not knowing who their biological parents are, and or biological donor dads or whatever you want to call it. There's so much terminology. There in Australia, for example, like there's open, everything's open. Like you have to be able to find out. So I think they're kind of moving that way. But when my mom did it, the advice the doctor gave her was never tell them, never bring it up, just let it go. And now like friends of mine who've conceived, through fertility, clinics and stuff, they say to them, tell your kids as soon as you can.
Yeah. It's like adoption.
Yeah. Adoption.
You read them a book about it and
yeah, tell them as soon as you can.
You were chosen.
You're chosen one.
Yeah. You're the chosen one. I love that book.
Give our kids more God complexes.
So you're like, you know, to get to book stuff, you're one of the biggest readers I know. Like voracious reader. You've read everything.
I like reading.
You like reading?
I really, yeah.
How often, like, give me your reading habits.
Like how much am I reading?
Yeah.
I read like a novel a week.
Okay. Audiobook or?
I usually have an audiobook going, but usually I'm like commuting to work. I'm listening to like it's usually like a memoir or nonfiction. But when I'm reading fiction.
And you read like in the morning or?
Yeah, I read in the morning. I read in my lunch break. I read at night before I go to bed.
So you always have a book.
Always have a, yeah.
Okay. And then you wrote this book over a period of how long?
About 8 years.
And you wrote it, what, during lunch breaks and, that, you know, when slow point, you know, slow office days or
yeah.
whatever?
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, I've been consulting for the last 8 years. I had my own company before I took this full-time job. And, you know, I could kind of set my own hours. So I would go in and I would write in the morning for a couple hours and then do my work. And it's easier when it's just you and you don't have, like, staff meetings and
right, all that stuff.
Bureaucratic bullshit.
Gets harder.
Get a lot more done. Yeah.
Do you feel like you're going to keep going? Like this is something that's like you
yeah.
built it into your life. You're going to keep writing.
Yeah. I'm working on something else already.
How far?
I'm like about 15,000 words.
Okay.
Something new.
That's pretty good.
Trying to write something shorter. This one got.
What is this? This is like 100,000 words?
165.
Jesus Christ.
I know. I couldn't stop.
Oh. Well, maybe next time it'll be what? 120.
It felt so good to finish that I just like, that's what I'm jonesing for again, is just being done.
Yeah. And then what about other kinds like screenwriting? Do you do any of that?
I'd done a lot of short story writing before I started the novel. I had a few things published and written some screenplays, have a pilot that I wrote about the whole fertility thing that I'm trying to do something with.
I feel like it's a funny, there's something funny there to be mined.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what a weird set of circumstances to have all these half-siblings.
Yeah.
Like, and then you meet them, like, I mean, I guess you like some of them better than others. You feel more of a connection. That's, that's natural.
Yeah.
And then, like, you meet your sisters.
The ones who are too, the ones who are too into it kind of freak me out. It's almost like when you meet, like, someone you're dating, and then all of a sudden they're, like, really into you really quickly, and you just kind of want to pull back.
Yeah.
That's what it's been like with a lot of these half-siblings.
Right.
Like, hey, big bro, what's going on?
Yeah, it's like,
fuck that. No, thank you.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm happy for you.
Thank you.
It's a big achievement, 160,000 words, and I'm glad that we got a chance to actually, I mean, you know, for people listening, Adam and I are buddies, and we see each other all the time, but I've learned some things about you that I didn't necessarily know. I'm happy to see you publishing this book. I'm glad I get to help you get the word out about it, and I wish you well on whatever comes next.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, that's Adam Greenfield. His novel, his debut novel, is called Circa. It's available now from Pelicanesis Press. It is the official August pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. Circa by Adam Greenfield. Go get your copy right now. Adam can be found on Twitter. His handle over there is at agreenfield73. I think I got that right. At agreenfield73. Right? Let me check this out. Make sure my brain is working. Yeah, it's agreenfield73 on Twitter. Thanks to Kill Rockstars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music. Thanks to Cigarette Royalty for the interstitial music. Don't forget, this podcast has its own official app. It's free. Go get it. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you want to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. All right, I hope I got to everything. I feel like I'm pressed for time. I'm feeling time constraints. Can you sense it? Can you feel that in my voice? All right. Hey, did I mention that we have an avocado tree in our yard that's actually bearing fruit? It's a miracle of nature.